You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Daniela Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, Czech books with David Vaughan about the poet and novelist Olga Valo, and a fresh edition of Science Journal with Christian Falvi, bringing you interviews with leading Czech scientists who have recently published articles in the prestigious American journal Nature, one mapping biodiversity mathematically and one fighting HIV. After that, you can hear another edition of From the Archives, which Radio Prague is currently rerunning. So do please stay with us for all that as we now get the show rolling with Czech Books. In this edition of Czech Books, David Vaughan meets the poet and novelist Olga Valo. In recent years, she has become something of a literary phenomenon in the Czech Republic, even though she was over 50 when her first novel was published in 1998. Prior to that, she was better known as a translator and dubbing director, a career which she describes as a form of inner emigration from communism. Her novels are strongly autobiographical, and Václav Havel has described them as a way of tracing the path which our nation travelled not so long ago.
The path that Václav Havel refers to can now also be traced by English readers, as Olga Valo's novel, Tightrope, A Bohemian Tale, has just been published in English translation. When Olga came to the studio, we talked about the book, but we began on a completely different subject. Like so many of the writers we have interviewed for this programme, Olga Valo has a link to Radio Prague. It's no coincidence that she has the same surname as one of our first announcers, way back in the 1930s, Zdenka Valo. I couldn't resist asking Olga about the connection, and I even managed to find a recording of Zdenka Valo in the radio archive.
Hallo? Praha, Brno, Bratislava, Košice, Moravská, Ostrava, Praha, Strašnice. Přejeme dobrý večer a vysíláme zprávy Československé tiskové kanceláře.
Zdenka Valo was a second wife of my grandfather. I am very sorry I have no opportunity to meet her because of, you say...
Because the tragedy of Zdenka Valo was that during the wartime occupation she was sent to Auschwitz because she was of Jewish origin and perished.
Zdenka Valo was a very interesting personality and a gifted person. She presented her program, I believe, in 2 or 3 or 4 languages. She was very devoted to her mother. Her mother was only 15 or 16 years older than her. She was a very young mother. And these two girls, practically girls, spent all their life together. And Zdenka followed her mother voluntarily to Terezín and Auschwitz too.
Because she was herself, she was only half Jewish, so in fact she didn't have to go, did she?
Yes, she was only half Jewish and was married with a Christian man, my grandfather.
Today, all that is left to remind us of Zdenka Valo at Czech Radio is a plaque bearing her name on a list of radio staff who were killed in the war by the entrance to the main radio building. Although Olga Valo has not yet written about her step-grandmother, she does plan to in the future. Her complicated and unusual family colours nearly all her writing. But perhaps, she says, having a complicated family is part of what it means to be Czech.
I am afraid family history of a majority of families in Czech Republic is a bit complicated because of history of this country at all. But this our family story is a story of outcasts.
How do you mean that?
It is a story of outcasts, of different types of being outcast. But there is a Czech proverb, and I'm not sure to translate it exactly. The raven or the crow sit beside the other crow.
The outcasts find one another.
Yes, outcasts find. Yes.
In the second half of the 20th century, to be an outcast in a totalitarian society as Czechoslovakia was particularly difficult, wasn't it? It didn't really tolerate eccentrics.
Definitely. Because if there is some freedom, there is some open space to be eccentric a bit. But in a totalitarian system, you should be black or white. It's impossible to live in such a distinct, such a sharp distinction.
And we're here to talk primarily about your book, Tightrope, A Bohemian Tale, which was published very recently, in November 2010, in English translation. This book is very much telling the story of your life as a girl growing up in Bohemia, in Czechoslovakia, in the 1950s. Perhaps we could start with a short extract. Your mother was an actress, your father a film and theatre director.
Yes.
So let's just hear a very brief extract about your mother.
My mother was an actress who did not want to act. In our Prague apartment, an old oak wardrobe hides a large cardboard box. On the cover it says, sugar cubes, 25 kilos. It is full of makeup, talcum powders, eyeshadows, grease paint, powder puffs, mineral jelly, a mirror sticky with all of them, along with the sweat and dust of actors changing rooms. Maminka sometimes, but seldom, opens the box and dives into its smell as if it were a tunnel to a hidden paradise. There was a mystical divide somewhere in time. The ugly box is material evidence of this. Once, Maminka was truly, but truly beautiful, and gifted, of course. Now, in the time after that, eaten away into regrettable rags of incomprehensible cinders, there is no reason anymore to put this truth to the test. Now Maminka doesn't want to go anywhere. She doesn't want to eat either.
And in that extract, it talks about your mother as an actress who didn't want to act. What happened?
I don't know what happened. She didn't want to act. The story of my mother is in this novel. I could not answer.
Because it's the complexity of it is the content of the novel.
Yes, it's the enigma for me till this time. So I could not simply answer. Sorry.
The book is, in a sense, an attempt to answer that, though, isn't it? And it's also an attempt to answer your what seems to be a very complicated relationship that you had with both your parents and with your broader family and with the time you were living in.
On one side, my father was a communist, a commie, a very red one and a very sincere one, but it's not excuse, it's just a fact. And a film director of very red movies. On the other side, he was for the origin of grand bourgeoisie. And it was very complicated at this time. On the other side, my mother was of farmer's origin.
But they were very much wealthy farmers, weren't they?
With
quite a big farm.
It was not such a big. It was just middle estate, less than 100 hectares. There were hard-laboring farmers. But after the year 48, they became the enemies.
After the communist takeover.
After the communist takeover, yeah.
And the farm sort of takes over a central role, really, in your book, doesn't it? It becomes a character, in a sense, in itself in the book, doesn't it?
In my book, in my mind, too. In my mind and in all my life, this hidden history, the hidden history of farmers. It is a story, forgotten story, I believe.
It's very clear from the book that you grew up with a very close relationship to the natural and to the agricultural world. Let's just have another extract here. This is describing your enjoyment of the cherries at the farm.
The cherries are beautiful and there are loads of them. I absorb the orgies of plenty, somewhere there above the ladder, picking them right from the branches with my mouth, spitting the stones all round, taking aim randomly. The juice splashing and flowing down. I'm wonderfully sticky and dirty. Just a little below me, on a rung of the ladder, lurks a singing and reproachful futility, because I should be doing something proper. Something should be created by now. My father has made his living by writing ever since he was 13, and I will be 13 in a few days. My father knows this very well. When he looks at me, his eyes are silent, hopeless.
My father understands himself as a poet, as a creative person. And I am afraid he did not make a distinction between himself and me. And he saw myself as a part of himself, and it was unbearable. Do something not useful in material way, but something great, something important, something meaningful. It's a very funny task for a little girl, 10 or 9 or 11 years old.
In terms of the language of the novel, there are some quite big jumps, aren't there, between sort of the language of philosophy and the language of the child and the language of the countryside. And the language of communism as well.
And language of communism. Language of communism is an important part of this, because one of big conflicts here is the conflict with a communist school, of a communist system of education.
Children, education is the foundation stone. I'm sorry for you. You're all victims of your parents. But don't worry, your children will no longer have such experiences. You will live in large collective houses and will do everything together. Cooking, ironing, washing, everything. And shooting, we've already started that, says Michael von Dobrowitz.
This book, Tightrope, it's published at the end of last year. It's beautifully produced. It also includes very useful notes that explain some of the specifically Czech aspects of the context of the story. And there's also a map showing where the farm is. Tell me, how did this book come about? It's very interesting, the fact that it was published in Hong Kong.
It happened by purely coincidence. I was invited like a guest on a workshop by Hong Kong Baptist University, and the team was the writers of Eastern Europe. I was there as a representative of Czech Republic, and it was really a great experience for me, because of Hong Kong is a very special nation. And I was very lucky to meet there Gillian Bickley of Proverse Publishing House. And especially the question of education in communism was really interesting for her, because she's an academic with a great experience in university of, I believe, 3 or 4 continents. The way how the English text was born, it is a story of its own.
It was actually translated by a team, wasn't it? And then it was edited by Gillian Bickley.
I said, Gillian, it's impossible to translate it. It's extremely difficult text. It's not so easy. And Gillian says, so try it. It was a challenge for me, and so I address all of my friends and non-friends who was English speaking, and I ask them to try to translate one chapter or two chapters, and two of them went on with the work, with the labor, and I'm very grateful to them.
We're out of time, but I would like to say again that Tightrope, A Bohemian Tale by Olga Vallor, my guest in the studio today, is published by Proverse Hong Kong, and you can buy it through the internet, through Amazon. Olga Vallor, thank you very much indeed for coming to the studio. Thank you.
Thank you for your invitation.
That edition of Czech Books with David Vaughan was first broadcast in April of last year. A reminder that you're with Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, where it's time now for Christian Falvey to bring you the latest from the world of Czech science.
In this edition of Science Journal, two interviews with Czech scientists who have recently published two very different articles in the prestigious American journal Nature, one mapping biodiversity mathematically and one fighting HIV. First is biologist and ecologist David Storch, who, along with his American colleagues, has come across a fascinating fact of nature, that the dependency of a given number of endemic animals on their environment creates a reliable mathematical pattern. It can tell us the rate at which a species will die off if its environment is destroyed. And interestingly, it applies universally, anywhere in the world, to vertebrates at least. Dr. Storch is the head of the Center for Theoretical Studies.
The point is that the people use the species area relationship, which is the relationship between area and number of species within the area, to estimate the current species loss, current species extinction. But the more appropriate pattern for this is the other pattern I have mentioned, this relationship between area and number of endemics. And we have shown that it is also universal, so we are able to predict the number of extinct species with arealos, exactly. Yeah.
And so are you able to say what would happen in a certain place under specific circumstances? For example, just to give an example, a European forest being encircled by housing development?
Well, yes, but of course we are able only to speak about the mean numbers. So it is actually quite rough estimate. But our results actually show that the number of species which potentially go extinct is more or less proportional to the area loss. So it's simple proportionality. But it is just a relative number. But the absolute number depends on mean range size. If species have small range sizes, if they occur only in limited area, the absolute number of extinct species is higher than if the species are widespread, which is quite obvious if you think about it.
And if we apply it specifically to the Shumava forest, for example, where the bark beetle rampage is destroying trees and they're trying to tear down the trees to destroy the bark beetle in turn, is there anything specific that can be gleaned by applying this pattern there?
The point is that I do not believe that there are real endemics in Shumava Mountains. So it is very improbable that any of the species would become extinct, because all the species which live in Shumava Mountains live also somewhere else. So I would not expect any really global extinction because these are widespread species in the forest. But the truth is that if there were endemics in Shumava as well, we would be able to predict the rate of extinction.
And so, how did you reach your result? What was the process of your work?
Okay, we just took the global data of distribution of all species of birds, amphibians, and mammals. And the advantage is that today we have really global distribution data in all the continents, and we just calculated number of species in different size windows on the Earth. And we realize that the relationship is different from what you normally find in the textbooks. In the textbooks, you find that the relationship should be linear if both area and the number of species is expressed in logarithmic scale. But we have found that actually the relationship is in this scale, logarithmic scale, upward accelerating, and also that it is universal for all the taxa. But basically we took the databases of all distributions of these three vertebrate classes across the world.
And were you surprised by that result, or was that your initial hypothesis?
Actually, it was. There were some theories which claimed that this should be the pattern. But we were surprised by the universality of the patterns, because we have realized that if we express area, if we standardize area and express it in the units which correspond to mean geographic range of species of every class, of these three classes in every continent, all the curves, which are upward accelerating, as I have mentioned, collapse into one general relationship. And this was really a big surprise, because this was not clear from the theories. And the second thing which surprised us was that when we plotted the endemics area relationship, so the relationship between species which are confined just to the particular area and don't occur anywhere else, then the relationship was more or less linear. And this is something which has never been described.
And lastly, how does this knowledge help us in practical terms from your point of view?
Well, you know, there is a long, long way from this very basic theoretical result to the practical things. But I think the most important finding is that potential extinction rate is more or less proportional to the area destroyed. So it's really quite a high rate of extinction related to the destruction of natural habitats. And also the other point which is important, but it is also something which has been known for a long time, is that the most vulnerable species are obviously the species which have very limited range size, which are located only in very small areas.
That was biologist and ecologist David Storch talking about his co-discovery of a new pattern of biodiversity. Elsewhere in Czech science, in the Institute of Chemical Technology to be exact, researchers have made a step forward in the fight against HIV/AIDS. What scientists like our next guest have done is find a new weak spot in the virus, one that can potentially be used to attack it in its immaturity, in its most vulnerable stage of development, and kill it in the bloodstream. Tomáš Rummel is one of those who has worked on this and other aspects of HIV for 17 years. I asked him, first of all, if that was indeed a proper explanation of such a complicated endeavor.
It's fair to say that we step forward with understanding of the particle and how it assembles and with the interactions. And this is the way how to design maybe more efficiently inhibitors. And on top of this, inhibitors which would block the first step of the assembly, which is assembly of so-called immature particles. Because virus goes through two forms. First one is assembled in the infected cell, which is immature particle. And then after release from the cells, it's completely reorganized after cleavage of by protease. And this is assembles again, but in some other form, which is called mature form.
Is your work already being put to practice in making better inhibitors, or how long a process will that be?
Actually, many laboratories are focused on making inhibitors, and I'd like to say we were the first who showed that the retrovirus-like particles can be assembled in vitro from isolated proteins. And this opened the way for many laboratories to study the assembly and organization of particles and interaction with compounds inhibiting the assembly. And now, with this understanding, we can see the shape of the molecules in the particles. And this would allow fitting in silico by computer some compounds into the particles. And this is the research we plan for the next couple of years. And many laboratories are focused on this. But the structure of the immature particles in this resolution was not known, in contrast to the mature particles.
You've said that your research is a hot field for scientists. Where do you think the field will be in 5, 10, 15 years?
Hard to predict, and in the beginning, scientists were very optimistic when HIV and AIDS emerged. Somebody said it's a question of 2 years to develop efficient antibodies. So I'm very careful to do such prediction. Actually, there are some promising inhibitors of even of assembly, because as you probably know, retrovirus is the copying of the genome. Is very inaccurate. It makes many errors, which makes many mutants, and some of them are resistant to inhibitors. Therefore, there is need for new inhibitors. They are now quite efficient inhibitors of virus enzymes, like protease and reverse transcriptase. And these are the compounds they are nowadays used for treatment of AIDS. But still, new resistant mutants are emerging, so therefore is need for new inhibitor.
Tomáš Rummel of the Prague College of Chemical Technology there, discussing Czech breakthroughs in the battle against HIV, ending this edition of Science Journal. More for you this time next month.
Science Journal with Christian Falvey, and the last part of today's show is devoted to days gone by in David Vaughan's popular mini-history series from the archives.
When Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union, it heralded a revolution in Soviet-American relations. At a series of high-profile summits beginning in Geneva in 1985, a growing personal trust developed between the Soviet and American leaders. Here is President Reagan from the Czech Radio Archives in Moscow on June 1, 1988.
The personal relationship between Mr. Gorbachev and me and the various members of our respective delegations has continued to deepen and improve. But personal relationships and hopes for peace are not by themselves enough. While at every turn I've tried to state our overwhelming desire for peace, I have also tried to note the existence of fundamental differences. And that's why it's a source of great satisfaction that those differences, in part as a result of these meetings, continue to recede.
While opening up to the West, the Soviet Union was also going through huge internal reforms, known as perestroika. And there were signs of similar changes in several of its Eastern Bloc allies, most noticeably in Poland and Hungary. So when President Gorbachev traveled to Czechoslovakia in April 1987, his visit was followed closely for signs of change. At a huge meeting in Prague's Palace of Culture with Communist Party and trade union activists, the Soviet leader was given a rapturous welcome with prolonged cheers and applause.
Дорогой товарищ Гусак, дорогие товарищи и друзья.
In the speech that followed, he was quite open about the less than healthy state of the Soviet economy and the urgent need for change.
Наши ракеты велико пресне нахазаї Халеєву комету.
Our rockets can locate Halley's comet with utmost precision. They can fly to Venus. And yet at the same time, we are seriously lagging behind in how we apply science and technology in the national economy, and our consumer goods are of poor quality. Experience tells us that socialism can only develop with criticism and self-criticism. Unfortunately, we have not always followed this rule.
Toto moudré pravidlo jsme ne vždy v praxi následovali.
Reform, Gorbachev said, was essential. But he tactfully added that it was up to Czechoslovakia itself to decide whether or not to follow a similar path.
Komunistická strana Československá a náš lid vřele podporují novátorský kurz komunistické strany Sovětského svazu.
The Czechoslovak president Gustav Husák assured Mr. Gorbachev that Czechoslovakia's Communist Party and people were fully behind the Soviet reforms. But the reality was that Czechoslovakia's political reforms were progressing at a snail's pace. Just a month before, several well-known figures from the jazz section of the Union of Musicians had been imprisoned in a trial that was evidently politically motivated. And there was also little sign of economic reform. Talking down a crackly phone line to the Czech section of Voice of America, Václav Havel, at the time the most prominent Czech dissident, was pessimistic about the potential of the country's leaders to change. Our leaders are only in power thanks to the Soviet invasion. They are put in place by Brezhnev's people in Moscow. They talk about reforms in Czechoslovakia, but in reality they don't want them, because if they really did start to introduce reforms, they would face big problems with their own identity and legitimacy. 2 years later, in November 1989, Václav Havel was proved right. Unlike in Poland and Hungary, there was no gradual change. It took hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Prague to persuade Czechoslovakia's hardline leadership that times had moved on.
That was David Vaughan with From the Archives, and I'm afraid it's all we have for you today. This is Danielle Lazarová saying thanks for joining us today and goodbye.